Chapter 30. That evening, when Archer came down before dinner, he found the drawing-room empty. He and May were dining alone, all the family engagements having been postponed since Mrs. Manson Mingott's illness, and as May was the more punctual of the two, he was surprised that she had not preceded him. He knew that she was at home, for while he dressed he had heard her moving about in her room, and he wondered what had delayed her. He had fallen into the way of dwelling on such conjectures as a means of tying his thoughts fast to reality. Sometimes he felt as if he had found the clue to his father-in-law's absorption in trifles. Perhaps even Mr. Welland long ago had had escapes and visions and had conjured up all the hosts of domesticity to defend himself against them. When May appeared, he thought she looked tired. She had put on the low-necked and tightly laced dinner dress which the Mingott ceremonial exacted on the most informal occasions, and had built her fair hair into its usual accumulated coils, and her face, in contrast, was wan and almost faded. But she shone on him with her usual tenderness, and her eyes had kept the blue dazzle of the day before. "What became of you, dear?" she asked. "I was waiting at Granny's, and Ellen came alone and said she had dropped you on the way because you had to rush off on business. There's nothing wrong."
"Only some letters I'd forgotten and wanted to get off before dinner."
"Ah," she said, and a moment afterward, "I'm sorry you didn't come to Granny's, unless the letters were urgent."
"They were," he rejoined, surprised at her insistence. "Besides, I don't see why I should have gone to your grandmother's. I didn't know you were there."
She turned and moved to the looking-glass above the mantelpiece. As she stood there, lifting her long arm to fasten a puff that had slipped from its place in her intricate hair, Archer was struck by something languid and inelastic in her attitude, and wondered if the deadly monotony of their lives had laid its weight on her also. Then he remembered that, as he had left the house that morning, she had called over the stairs that she would meet him at her grandmother's so that they might drive home together. He had called back a cheery, "Yes," and then, absorbed in other visions, had forgotten his promise. Now he was smitten with compunction, yet irritated that so trifling an omission should be stored up against him after nearly 2 years of marriage. He was weary of living in a perpetual tepid honeymoon without the temperature of passion, yet with all its exactions. If May had spoken out her grievances, he suspected her of many, he might have laughed them away. But she was trained to conceal imaginary wounds under a Spartan smile. To disguise his own annoyance, he asked how her grandmother was, and she answered that Mrs. Mingott was still improving, but had been rather disturbed by the last news about the Beauforts.
"What news?"
"It seems they're going to stay in New York. I believe he's going into an insurance business or something. They're looking about for a small house." The preposterousness of the case was beyond discussion, and they went in to dinner. During dinner their talk moved in its usual limited circle, but Archer noticed that his wife made no allusion to Madame Olenska, nor to old Catherine's reception of her. He was thankful for the fact, yet felt it to be vaguely ominous. They went up to the library for coffee, and Archer lit a cigar and took down a volume of Michelet. He had taken to history in the evenings, since May had shown a tendency to ask him to read aloud whenever she saw him with a volume of poetry. Not that he disliked the sound of his own voice, but because he could always foresee her comments on what he read. In the days of their engagement she had simply, as he now perceived, echoed what he told her. But since he had ceased to provide her with opinions, she had begun to hazard her own, with results destructive to his enjoyment of the works commented on. Seeing that he had chosen history, she fetched her workbasket, drew up an armchair to the green-shaded student lamp, and uncovered a cushion she was embroidering for his sofa. She was not a clever needlewoman.
Her large, capable hands were made for riding, rowing, and open-air activities, but since other wives embroidered cushions for their husbands, she did not wish to omit this last link in her devotion. She was so placed that Archer, by merely raising his eyes, could see her bent above her work-frame, her ruffled elbow sleeves slipping back from her firm round arms, the betrothal sapphire shining on her left hand above her broad gold wedding ring, and the right hand slowly and laboriously stabbing the canvas. As she sat thus, the lamplight full on her clear brow, he said to himself with a secret dismay that he would always know the thoughts behind it, that never in all the years to come would she surprise him by an unexpected mood, by a new idea, a weakness, a cruelty, or an emotion. She had spent her poetry and romance on their short courting. The function was exhausted because the need was past. Now she was simply ripening into a copy of her mother, and mysteriously, by the very process, trying to turn him into a Mr. Welland. He laid down his book and stood up impatiently, and at once she raised her head. "What's the matter?"
"The room is stifling. I want a little air."
He had insisted that the library curtains should draw backward and forward on a rod, so that they might be closed in the evening, instead of remaining nailed to a gilt cornice and immovably looped up over layers of lace, as in the drawing-room. And he pulled them back and pushed up the sash, leaning out into the icy night. The mere fact of not looking at May, seated beside his table, under his lamp, the fact of seeing other houses, roofs, chimneys, of getting the sense of other lives outside his own, other cities beyond New York, and a whole world beyond his world, cleared his brain and made it easier to breathe. After he had leaned out into the darkness for a few minutes, he heard her say, "Newland, do shut the window. You'll catch your death." He pulled the sash down and turned back.
"Catch my death," he echoed, and he felt like adding, "But I've caught it already. I am dead. I've been dead for months and months."
And suddenly the play of the word flashed up a wild suggestion. What if it were she who was dead? If she were going to die soon, and leave him free. The sensation of standing there in that warm, familiar room and looking at her and wishing her dead was so strange, so fascinating and overmastering that its enormity did not immediately strike him. He simply felt that chance had given him a new possibility to which his sick soul might cling. Yes. May might die. People did. Young people, healthy people like herself. She might die, and set him suddenly free. She glanced up, and he saw by her widening eyes that there must be something strange in his own. "Newland, are you ill?" He shook his head and turned toward his armchair. She bent over her work-frame, and as he passed, he laid his hand on her hair.
"Poor May," he said.
"Poor? Why poor?" she echoed with a strained laugh.
"Because I shall never be able to open a window without worrying you," he rejoined, laughing also.
For a moment she was silent, then she said very low, her head bowed over her work, "I shall never worry if you're happy."
"Ah, my dear, and I shall never be happy unless I can open the windows."
"In this weather," she remonstrated, and with a sigh he buried his head in his book. 6 or 7 days passed. Archer heard nothing from Madame Olenska and became aware that her name would not be mentioned in his presence by any member of the family. He did not try to see her. To do so while she was at old Catherine's guarded bedside would have been almost impossible. In the uncertainty of the situation, he let himself drift, conscious, somewhere below the surface of his thoughts, of a resolve which had come to him when he had leaned out from his library window into the icy night. The strength of that resolve made it easy to wait and make no sign. Then one day May told him that Mrs. Manson Mingott had asked to see him. There was nothing surprising in the request, for the old lady was steadily recovering, and she had always openly declared that she preferred Archer to any of her other grandsons-in-law. May gave the message with evident pleasure. She was proud of old Catherine's appreciation of her husband. There was a moment's pause, and then Archer felt it incumbent on him to say,
"All right, shall we go together this afternoon?"
His wife's face brightened, but she instantly answered, "Oh, you'd much better go alone. It bores Granny to see the same people too often." Archer's heart was beating violently when he rang old Mrs. Mingott's bell. He had wanted, above all things, to go alone, for he felt sure the visit would give him the chance of saying a word in private to the Countess Olenska. He had determined to wait till the chance presented itself naturally. And here it was, and here he was on the doorstep. Behind the door, behind the curtains of the yellow damask room next to the hall, she was surely awaiting him. In another moment he should see her and be able to speak to her before she led him to the sick room. He wanted only to put one question. After that, his course would be clear. What he wished to ask was simply the date of her return to Washington, and that question she could hardly refuse to answer. But in the yellow sitting room it was the mulatto maid who waited. Her white teeth shining like a keyboard, she pushed back the sliding doors and ushered him into old Catherine's presence. The old woman sat in a vast, throne-like armchair near her bed. Beside her was a mahogany stand bearing a cast bronze lamp with an engraved globe, over which a green paper shade had been balanced. There was not a book or a newspaper in reach, nor any evidence of feminine employment. Conversation had always been Mrs. Mingott's sole pursuit, and she would have scorned to feign an interest in fancy work. Archer saw no trace of the slight distortion left by her stroke. She merely looked paler, with darker shadows in the folds and recesses of her obesity, and in the fluted mob cap tied by a starched bow between her first two chins and the muslin kerchief crossed over her billowing purple dressing gown, she seemed like some shrewd and kindly ancestress of her own who might have yielded too freely to the pleasures of the table. She held out one of the little hands that nestled in a hollow of her huge lap like pet animals and called to the maid, "Don't let in anyone else. If my daughters call, say I'm asleep." The maid disappeared, and the old lady turned to her grandson. "My dear, am I perfectly hideous?" she asked gaily, launching out one hand in search of the folds of muslin on her inaccessible bosom. "My daughters tell me it doesn't matter at my age, as if hideousness didn't matter all the more the harder it gets to conceal." "My dear, you're handsomer than ever," Archer rejoined in the same tone, and she threw back her head and laughed. "Ah, but not as handsome as Ellen," she jerked out, twinkling at him maliciously, and before he could answer she added, "Was she so awfully handsome the day you drove her up from the ferry?" He laughed, and she continued, "Was it because you told her so that she had to put you out on the way? In my youth, young men didn't desert pretty women unless they were made to." She gave another chuckle and interrupted it to say almost querulously, "It's a pity she didn't marry you. I always told her so. It would have spared me all this worry. But who ever thought of sparing their grandmother worry?" Archer wondered if her illness had blurred her faculties. But suddenly she broke out, "Well, it's settled anyhow. She's going to stay with me, whatever the rest of the family say. She hadn't been here 5 minutes before I'd have gone down on my knees to keep her, if only for the last 20 years I'd been able to see where the floor was." Archer listened in silence, and she went on, "They'd talked me over, as no doubt you know,
persuaded me, Lovell and Letter Blair and Augusta Welland and all the rest of them, that I must hold out and cut off her allowance till she was made to see that it was her duty to go back to Olenski. They thought they'd convinced me when the secretary, or whatever he was, came out with the last proposals. Handsome proposals, I confess they were. After all, marriage is marriage, and money's money, both useful things in their way, and I didn't know what to answer.
She broke off and drew a long breath, as if speaking had become an effort.
But the minute I laid eyes on her, I said, "You sweet bird, you! Shut you up in that cage again? Never! And now it's settled that she's to stay here and nurse her granny as long as there's a granny to nurse. It's not a gay prospect, but she doesn't mind. And of course I've told Letter Blair that she's to be given her proper allowance."
The young man heard her with veins aglow, but in his confusion of mind he hardly knew whether her news brought joy or pain. He had so definitely decided on the course he meant to pursue that for the moment he could not readjust his thoughts. But gradually there stole over him the delicious sense of difficulties deferred and opportunities miraculously provided. If Ellen had consented to come and live with her grandmother, it must surely be because she had recognized the impossibility of giving him up. This was her answer to his final appeal of the other day. If she would not take the extreme step he had urged, she had at last yielded to half measures. He sank back into the thought with the involuntary relief of a man who has been ready to risk everything and suddenly tastes the dangerous sweetness of security.
"She couldn't have gone back. It was impossible," he exclaimed. "Ah, my dear, I always knew you were on her side. And that's why I sent for you today, and why I said to your pretty wife when she proposed to come with you, 'No, my dear, I'm pining to see Newland, and I don't want anybody to share our transports.' For you see, my dear," she drew her head back as far as its tethering chins permitted and looked him full in the eyes, "you see, we shall have a fight yet. The family don't want her here, and they'll say it's because I've been ill, because I'm a weak old woman, that she's persuaded me. I'm not well enough yet to fight them one by one, and you've got to do it for me."
I?
He stammered.
"You? Why not?"
She jerked back at him, her round eyes suddenly as sharp as penknives. Her hand fluttered from its chair-arm and lit on his with a clutch of little pale nails like bird claws.
"Why not?" she searchingly repeated.
Archer, under the exposure of her gaze, had recovered his self-possession.
"Oh, I don't count. I'm too insignificant." "Well, you're Letter Blair's partner, ain't you? You've got to get at them through Letter Blair. Unless you've got a reason," she insisted. "Oh, my dear, I back you to hold your own against them all without my help. But you shall have it if you need it," he reassured her. "Then we're safe," she sighed.
And smiling on him with all her ancient cunning, she added, as she settled her head among the cushions,
"I always knew you'd back us up, because they never quote you when they talk about its being her duty to go home."
He winced a little at her terrifying perspicacity and longed to ask,
"And May, do they quote her?"
But he judged it safer to turn the question.
"And Madame Olenska, when am I to see her?" he said.
The old lady chuckled, crumpled her lids, and went through the pantomime of archness.
"Not today. One at a time, please. Madame Olenska's gone out."
He flushed with disappointment, and she went on, "She's gone out, my child, gone in my carriage to see Regina Beaufort." She paused for this announcement to produce its effect. "That's what she's reduced me to already. The day after she got here, she put on her best bonnet and told me, as cool as a cucumber, that she was going to call on Regina Beaufort. 'I don't know her. Who is she?' says I. 'She's your grandniece and a most unhappy woman,' she says. 'She's the wife of a scoundrel,' I answered. 'Well,' she says, 'and so am I. And yet all my family want me to go back to him.' Well, that floored me, and I let her go. And finally, one day, she said it was raining too hard to go out on foot, and she wanted me to lend her my carriage. 'What for?' I asked her, and she said, 'To go and see Cousin Regina.' Cousin! Now, my dear, I looked out of the window and saw it wasn't raining a drop. But I understood her, and I let her have the carriage. After all, Regina's a brave woman, and so is she. And I've always liked courage above everything.'"
Archer bent down and pressed his lips on the little hand that still lay on his.
"Eh-eh-eh! Whose hand did you think you were kissing, young man? Your wife's, I hope," the old lady snapped out with her mocking cackle. And as he rose to go, she called out after him, "Give her her granny's love, but you better not say anything about our talk."
Chapter 31. Archer had been stunned by old Catherine's news. It was only natural that Madame Olenska should have hastened from Washington in response to her grandmother's summons, but that she should have decided to remain under her roof, especially now that Mrs. Mingott had almost regained her health, was less easy to explain. Archer was sure that Madame Olenska's decision had not been influenced by the change in her financial situation. He knew the exact figure of the small income which her husband had allowed her at their separation. Without the addition of her grandmother's allowance, it was hardly enough to live on, in any sense known to the Mingott vocabulary. And now that Medora Manson, who shared her life, had been ruined, such a pittance would barely keep the two women clothed and fed. Yet Archer was convinced that Madame Olenska had not accepted her grandmother's offer from interested motives. She had the heedless generosity and the spasmodic extravagance of persons used to large fortunes and indifferent to money. But she could go without many things which her relations considered indispensable, and Mrs. Lovell Mingott and Mrs. Welland had often been heard to deplore that anyone who had enjoyed the cosmopolitan luxuries of Count Olenski's establishments should care so little about how things were done. Moreover, as Archer knew, several months had passed since her allowance had been cut off, yet in the interval she had made no effort to regain her grandmother's favor. Therefore, if she had changed her course, it must be for a different reason. He did not have far to seek for that reason. On the way from the ferry, she had told him that he and she must remain apart, but she had said it with her head on his breast. He knew that there was no calculated coquetry in her words. She was fighting her fate as he had fought his, and clinging desperately to her resolve that they should not break faith with the people who trusted them. But during the 10 days which had elapsed since her return to New York, she had perhaps guessed from his silence and from the fact of his making no attempt to see her that he was meditating a decisive step, a step from which there was no turning back. At the thought, a sudden fear of her own weakness might have seized her, and she might have felt that, after all, it was better to accept the compromise usual in such cases and follow the line of least resistance. An hour earlier, when he had rung Mrs. Mingott's bell, Archer had fancied that his path was clear before him. He had meant to have a word alone with Madame Olenska, and failing that, to learn from her grandmother on what day and by which train she was returning to Washington. In that train he intended to join her and travel with her to Washington, or as much farther as she was willing to go. His own fancy inclined to Japan.
At any rate, she would understand at once that wherever she went, he was going. He meant to leave a note for May that should cut off any other alternative. He had fancied himself not only nerved for this plunge, but eager to take it. Yet his first feeling on hearing that the course of events was changed had been one of relief. Now, however, as he walked home from Mrs. Mingott's, he was conscious of a growing distaste for what lay before him. There was nothing unknown or unfamiliar in the path he was presumably to tread, but when he had trodden it before, it was as a free man who was accountable to no one for his actions and could lend himself with an amused detachment to the game of precautions and prevarications, concealments and compliances that the part required. This procedure was called protecting a woman's honor, and the best fiction, combined with the after-dinner talk of his elders, had long since initiated him into every detail of its code. Now he saw the matter in a new light, and his part in it seemed singularly diminished. It was, in fact, that which, with a secret fatuity, he had watched Mrs. Thorley Rushworth play toward a fond and unperceiving husband— a smiling, bantering, humoring, watchful, and incessant lie. A lie by day, a lie by night, a lie in every touch and every look, a lie in every caress and every quarrel, a lie in every word and in every silence. It was easier, and less dastardly on the whole, for a wife to play such a part toward her husband. A woman's standard of truthfulness was tacitly held to be lower. She was the subject creature, and versed in the arts of the enslaved. Then she could always plead moods and nerves, and the right not to be held too strictly to account. And even in the most straight-laced societies, the laugh was always against the husband. But in Archer's little world no one laughed at a wife deceived, and a certain measure of contempt was attached to men who continued their philandering after marriage. In the rotation of crops there was to be a recognized season for wild oats, but they were not to be sown more than once. Archer had always shared this view. In his heart he thought Lefferts despicable. But to love Ellen Olenska was not to become a man like Lefferts. For the first time, Archer found himself face to face with the dread argument of the individual case. Ellen Olenska was like no other woman. He was like no other man. Their situation, therefore, resembled no one else's, and they were answerable to no tribunal but that of their own judgment. Yes. But in 10 minutes more he would be mounting his own doorstep, and there were May, and habit, and honor, and all the old decencies that he and his people had always believed in. At his corner he hesitated, and then walked on down Fifth Avenue. Ahead of him in the winter night loomed a big unlit house. As he drew near, he thought how often he had seen it blazing with lights, its steps awninged and carpeted, and carriages waiting in double line to draw up at the curbstone. It was in the conservatory that stretched its dead black bulk down the side street that he had taken his first kiss from May. It was under the myriad candles of the ballroom that he had seen her appear, tall and silver-shining as a young Diana. Now the house was as dark as the grave, except for a faint flare of gas in the basement and a light in one upstairs room where the blind had not been lowered. As Archer reached the corner, he saw that the carriage standing at the door was Mrs. Manson Mingott's. What an opportunity for Sillerton Jackson if he should chance to pass! Archer had been greatly moved by old Catherine's account of Madame Olenska's attitude toward Mrs. Beaufort. It made the righteous reprobation of New York seem like a passing by on the other side. But he knew well enough what construction the clubs and drawing-rooms would put on Ellen Olenska's visits to her cousin. He paused and looked up at the lighted window. No doubt the two women were sitting together in that room. Beaufort had probably sought consolation elsewhere. There were even rumors that he had left New York with Fanny Ring. But Mrs. Beaufort's attitude made the report seem improbable. Archer had the nocturnal perspective of Fifth Avenue almost to himself. At that hour, most people were indoors dressing for dinner, and he was secretly glad that Ellen's exit was likely to be unobserved. As the thought passed through his mind, the door opened, and she came out. Behind her was a faint light, such as might have been carried down the stairs to show her the way. She turned to say a word to someone, then the door closed, and she came down the steps. "Ellen," he said in a low voice as she reached the pavement. She stopped with a slight start, and just then he saw two young men of fashionable cut approaching. There was a familiar air about their overcoats and the way their smart silk mufflers were folded over their white ties, and he wondered how youths of their quality happened to be dining out so early. Then he remembered that the Reggie Chiverses, whose house was a few doors above, were taking a large party that evening to see Adelaide Neilson in Romeo and Juliet, and guessed that the two were of the number. They passed under the lamp, and he recognized Lawrence Lefferts and a young Chivers. A mean desire not to have Madame Olenska seen at the Beauforts' door vanished as he felt the penetrating warmth of her hand. "I shall see you now. We shall be together," he broke out, hardly knowing what he said. "Ah," she answered. "Granny has told you." While he watched her, he was aware that Lefferts and Chivers, on reaching the farther side of the street corner, had discreetly struck away across Fifth Avenue. It was the kind of masculine solidarity that he himself often practiced. Now he sickened at their connivance. Did she really imagine that he and she could live like this? And if not, what else did she imagine? "Tomorrow I must see you. Somewhere where we can be alone," he said in a voice that sounded almost angry to his own ears. She wavered and moved toward the carriage. "But I shall be at Granny's, for the present, that is," she added, as if conscious that her change of plans required some explanation. "Somewhere where we can be alone," he insisted. She gave a faint laugh that grated on him. "In New York? But there are no churches, no monuments." "There's the art museum in the park," he explained, as she looked puzzled. "At 2:30, I shall be at the door." She turned away without answering and got quickly into the carriage. As it drove off, she leaned forward, and he thought she waved her hand in the obscurity. He stared after her in a turmoil of contradictory feelings. It seemed to him that he had been speaking not to the woman he loved, but to another, a woman he was indebted to for pleasures already wearied of. It was hateful to find himself the prisoner of this hackneyed vocabulary. "She'll come," he said to himself almost contemptuously. Avoiding the popular Wolf collection, whose anecdotic canvases filled one of the main galleries of the queer wilderness of cast iron and encaustic tiles known as the Metropolitan Museum, they had wandered down a passage to the room where the Cesnola antiquities moldered in unvisited loneliness. They had this melancholy retreat to themselves, and seated on the divan enclosing the central steam radiator, they were staring silently at the glass cabinets mounted in ebonized wood which contained the recovered fragments of ilium. "It's odd," Madame Olenska said. "I never came here before."
"Ah, well, someday, I suppose, it will be a great museum."
"Yes," she answered absently. She stood up and wandered across the room. Archer, remaining seated, watched the light movements of her figure, so girlish even under its heavy furs, the cleverly planted heron wing in her fur cap, and the way a dark curl lay like a flattened vine spiral on each cheek above the ear. His mind, as always when they first met, was wholly absorbed in the delicious details that made her herself and no other. Presently he rose and approached the case before which she stood. Its glass shelves were crowded with small broken objects, hardly recognizable domestic utensils, ornaments, and personal trifles, made of glass, of clay, of discolored bronze, and other time-blurred substances. "It seems cruel," she said, "that after a while nothing matters, any more than these little things that used to be necessary and important to forgotten people, and now have to be guessed at under a magnifying glass and labeled use unknown."
"Yes, but meanwhile..."
"Ah, meanwhile?"
As she stood there in her long sealskin coat, her hands thrust in a small round muff, her veil drawn down like a transparent mask to the tip of her nose, and the bunch of violets he had brought her stirring with her quickly taken breath, it seemed incredible that this pure harmony of line and color should ever suffer the stupid law of change.
"Meanwhile, everything matters that concerns you," he said.
She looked at him thoughtfully and turned back to the divan. He sat down beside her and waited. But suddenly he heard a step echoing far off down the empty rooms and felt the pressure of the minutes.
"What is it you wanted to tell me?" she asked, as if she had received the same warning.
"What I wanted to tell you?" he rejoined. "Why... that I believe you came to New York because you were afraid."
"Afraid?"
"Of my coming to Washington."
She looked down at her muff, and he saw her hands stir in it uneasily.
"Well?"
"Well, yes," she said.
"You were afraid. You knew."
"Yes, I knew."
"Well, then," he insisted.
"Well, then, this is better, isn't it?"
she returned with a long, questioning sigh.
"Better?"
"We shall hurt others less. Isn't it, after all, what you have always wanted?"
"To have you here, you mean, in reach, and yet out of reach? To meet you in this way, on the sly? It's the very reverse of what I want. I told you the other day what I wanted."
She hesitated.
"And you still think this worse?"
"A thousand times." He paused. "It would be easy to lie to you. But the truth is, I think it detestable."
"Oh, so do I,"
she cried with a deep breath of relief. He sprang up impatiently.
"Well, then, it's my turn to ask. What is it, in God's name, that you think better?"
She hung her head and continued to clasp and unclasp her hands in her muff. The step drew nearer, and a guardian in a braided cap walked listlessly through the room like a ghost stalking through a necropolis. They fixed their eyes simultaneously on the case opposite them, and when the official figure had vanished down a vista of mummies and sarcophagi, Archer spoke again.
"What do you think better?"
Instead of answering, she murmured,
"I promised Granny to stay with her because it seemed to me that here I would be safer."
"From me?"
She bent her head slightly without looking at him.
"Safer from loving me?"
Her profile did not stir, but he saw a tear overflow on her lashes and hang in a mesh of her veil.
"Safer from doing irreparable harm. Don't let us be like all the others," she protested.
"What others? I don't profess to be different from my kind. I'm consumed by the same wants and the same longings."
She glanced at him with a kind of terror, and he saw a faint color steal into her cheeks.
"Shall I once come to you and then go home?"
she suddenly hazarded in a low, clear voice. The blood rushed to the young man's forehead.
"Dearest," he said without moving,
It seemed as if he held his heart in his hands, like a full cup that the least motion might overbrim. Then her last phrase struck his ear, and his face clouded.
"Go home? What do you mean by going home?"
"Home to my husband."
"And you expect me to say yes to that?"
She raised her troubled eyes to his. "What else is there? I can't stay here and lie to the people who've been good to me."
"But that's the very reason why I ask you to come away."
"And destroy their lives when they've helped me to remake mine?" Archer sprang to his feet and stood looking down on her in inarticulate despair. It would have been easy to say, "Yes, come. Come once." He knew the power she would put in his hands if she consented. There would be no difficulty then in persuading her not to go back to her husband. But something silenced the word on his lips. A sort of passionate honesty in her made it inconceivable that he should try to draw her into that familiar trap.
"If I were to let her come," he said to himself, "I should have to let her go again."
And that was not to be imagined. But he saw the shadow of the lashes on her wet cheek and wavered.
"After all," he began again, "we have lives of our own. There's no use attempting the impossible. You're so unprejudiced about something, so used, as you say, to looking at the Gorgon, that I don't know why you're afraid to face our case and see it as it really is. Unless you think the sacrifice is not worth making."
She stood up also, her lips tightening under a rapid frown. "Call it that, then. I must go," she said, drawing her little watch from her bosom. She turned away, and he followed and caught her by the wrist.
"Well, then, come to me once," he said,
his head turning suddenly at the thought of losing her. And for a second or two they looked at each other almost like enemies.
"When?" he insisted. "Tomorrow?"
She hesitated. "The day after."
"Dearest," he said again.
She had disengaged her wrist, but for a moment they continued to hold each other's eyes, and he saw that her face, which had grown very pale, was flooded with a deep inner radiance. His heart beat with awe. He felt that he had never before beheld love visible. "Oh, I shall be late. Goodbye." "No, don't come any farther than this," she cried, walking hurriedly away down the long room, as if the reflected radiance in his eyes had frightened her. When she reached the door, she turned for a moment to wave a quick farewell. Archer walked home alone. Darkness was falling when he let himself into his house, and he looked about at the familiar objects in the hall as if he viewed them from the other side of the grave. The parlor maid, hearing his step, ran up the stairs to light the gas on the upper landing.
"Is Mrs. Archer in?"
"No, sir. Mrs. Archer went out in the carriage after luncheon and hasn't come back." With a sense of relief, he entered the library and flung himself down in his armchair. The parlor maid followed, bringing the student lamp and shaking some coals onto the dying fire. When she left, he continued to sit motionless, his elbows on his knees, his chin on his clasped hands, his eyes fixed on the red grate. He sat there without conscious thoughts, without sense of the lapse of time, in a deep and grave amazement that seemed to suspend life rather than quicken it.
"This was what had to be, then. This was what had to be," he kept repeating to himself, as if he hung in the clutch of doom.
What he had dreamed of had been so different that there was a mortal chill in his rapture. The door opened and May came in. "I'm dreadfully late. You weren't worried, were you?" she asked, laying her hand on his shoulder in one of her rare caresses. He looked up, astonished.
"Is it late?"
"After 7. I believe you've been asleep,"
she laughed, and drawing out her hatpins, tossed her velvet hat on the sofa. She looked paler than usual, but sparkling with an unwonted animation.
"I went to see Granny, and just as I was going away, Ellen came in from a walk, so I stayed and had a long talk with her. It was ages since we'd had a real talk."
She had dropped into her usual armchair, facing his, and was running her fingers through her rumpled hair. He fancied she expected him to speak. "A really good talk," she went on, smiling with what seemed to Archer an unnatural vividness. "She was so dear, just like the old Ellen. I'm afraid I haven't been fair to her lately. I've sometimes thought..."
Archer stood up and leaned against the mantelpiece out of the radius of the lamp.
"Yes, you've thought," he echoed as she paused.
"Well, perhaps I haven't judged her fairly. She's so different, at least on the surface. She takes up such odd people. She seems to like to make herself conspicuous. I suppose it's the life she's led in that fast European society. No doubt we seem dreadfully dull to her, but I don't want to judge her unfairly."
She paused again, a little breathless with the unwanted length of her speech, and sat with her lips slightly parted and a deep blush on her cheeks. Archer, as he looked at her, was reminded of the glow that had suffused her face in the Mission Garden at St. Augustine. He became aware of the same obscure effort in her, the same reaching out towards something beyond the usual range of her vision.
"She hates Ellen," he thought, "and she's trying to overcome the feeling, and to get me to help her to overcome it."
The thought moved him, and for a moment he was on the point of breaking the silence between them and throwing himself on her mercy.
"You understand, don't you," she went on, "why the family have sometimes been annoyed? We all did what we could for her at first, but she never seemed to understand, and now this idea of going to see Mrs. Beaufort, of going there in Granny's carriage. I'm afraid she's quite alienated the van der Luydens."
"Ah," said Archer with an impatient laugh. The open door had closed between them again.
"It's time to dress. We're dining out, aren't we?" he asked, moving from the fire.
She rose also, but lingered near the hearth. As he walked past her, she moved forward impulsively, as though to detain him. Their eyes met, and he saw that hers were of the same swimming blue as when he had left her to drive to Jersey City. She flung her arms about his neck and pressed her cheek to his.
"You haven't kissed me today," she said in a whisper,
and he felt her tremble in his arms.
Chapter 32.
"At the court of the Tuileries," said Mr. Sillerton Jackson with his reminiscent smile, "such things were pretty openly tolerated."
The scene was the van der Luydens' black walnut dining room in Madison Avenue, and the time the evening after Newland Archer's visit to the Museum of Art. Mr. and Mrs. van der Luyden had come to town for a few days from Skuytercliff, whither they had precipitately fled at the announcement of Beaufort's failure. It had been represented to them that the disarray into which society had been thrown by this deplorable affair made their presence in town more necessary than ever. It was one of the occasions when, as Mrs. Archer put it, they owed it to society to show themselves at the opera, and even to open their own doors.
"It will never do, my dear Louisa, to let people like Mrs. Lemuel Struthers think they can step into Regina's shoes. It is just at such times that new people rush in and get a footing. It was owing to the epidemic of chickenpox in New York the winter Mrs. Struthers first appeared that the married men slipped away to her house while their wives were in the nursery. You and dear Henry Louisa must stand in the breach, as you always have."
Mr. and Mrs. van der Luyden could not remain deaf to such a call, and reluctantly but heroically they had come to town, unmuffled the house, and sent out invitations for two dinners and an evening reception. On this particular evening, they had invited Sillerton Jackson, Mrs. Archer, and Newland and his wife to go with them to the opera, where Faust was being sung for the first time that winter. Nothing was done without ceremony under the van der Luyden roof, and though there were but four guests, the repast had begun at 7 punctually, so that the proper sequence of courses might be served without haste before the gentlemen settled down to their cigars. Archer had not seen his wife since the evening before. He had left early for the office, where he had plunged into an accumulation of unimportant business. In the afternoon, one of the senior partners had made an unexpected call on his time, and he had reached home so late that May had preceded him to the van der Luydens and sent back the carriage. Now, across the Skuytercliff carnations and the massive plate, she struck him as pale and languid, but her eyes shone, and she talked with exaggerated animation. The subject which had called forth Mr. Sillerton Jackson's favorite allusion had been brought up, Archer fancied, not without intention, by their hostess. The Beaufort failure, or rather the Beaufort attitude since the failure, was still a fruitful theme for the drawing-room moralist, and after it had been thoroughly examined and condemned, Mrs. van der Luyden had turned her scrupulous eyes on May Archer. "Is it possible, dear, that what I hear is true? I was told your grandmother Mingott's carriage was seen standing at Mrs. Beaufort's door." It was noticeable that she no longer called the offending lady by her Christian name. May's color rose, and Mrs. Archer put in hastily, "If it was, I'm convinced it was there without Mrs. Mingott's knowledge." "Ah, you think—" Mrs. van der Luyden paused, sighed, and glanced at her husband. "I'm afraid," Mr. van der Luyden said, "that Madame Olenska's kind heart may have led her into the imprudence of calling on Mrs. Beaufort."
"Or her taste for peculiar people," put in Mrs. Archer in a dry tone, while her eyes dwelt innocently on her son's.
"I'm sorry to think it of Madame Olenska," said Mrs. van der Luyden, and Mrs. Archer murmured, "Ah, my dear, and after you've had her twice at Skuytercliff." It was at this point that Mr. Jackson seized the chance to place his favorite allusion. "At the Tuileries," he repeated, seeing the eyes of the company expectantly turned on him, "the standard was excessively lax in some respects. And if you'd ask where Morney's money came from, or who paid the debts of some of the court beauties—"
"I hope, dear Sillerton," said Mrs. Archer, "you are not suggesting that we should adopt such standards."
"I never suggest," returned Mr. Jackson imperturbably.
"But Madame Olenska's foreign upbringing may make her less particular."
"Ah." The two elder ladies sighed.
"Still, to have kept her grandmother's carriage at a defaulter's door," Mr. van der Luyden protested, and Archer guessed that he was remembering and resenting the hampers of carnations he had sent to the little house in 23rd Street.
"Of course, I've always said that she looks at things quite differently," Mrs. Archer summed up. A flush rose to May's forehead. She looked across the table at her husband and said precipitately, "I'm sure Ellen meant it kindly."
"Imprudent people are often kind," said Mrs. Archer,
as if the fact were scarcely an extenuation. And Mrs. van der Luyden murmured,
"If only she had consulted someone." "Ah, that she never did," Mrs. Archer rejoined.
At this point Mr. van der Luyden glanced at his wife, who bent her head slightly in the direction of Mrs. Archer, and the glimmering trains of the three ladies swept out of the door while the gentlemen settled down to their cigars. Mr. van der Luyden supplied short ones on opera nights, but they were so good that they made his guests deplore his inexorable punctuality. Archer, after the first act, had detached himself from the party and made his way to the back of the club box. From there he watched over various Chivers, Mingott, and Rushworth shoulders the same scene that he had looked at 2 years previously on the night of his first meeting with Ellen Olenska. He had half expected her to appear again in old Mrs. Mingott's box, but it remained empty, and he sat motionless, his eyes fastened on it, till suddenly Madame Nielsen's pure soprano broke out into, "Mama, non, mama." Archer turned to the stage, where, in the familiar setting of giant roses and penwiper pansies, the same large blonde victim was succumbing to the same small brown seducer. From the stage his eyes wandered to the point of the horseshoe where May sat between two older ladies, just as on that former evening she had sat between Mrs. Lovell Mingott and her newly arrived foreign cousin. As on that evening, she was all in white, and Archer, who had not noticed what she wore, recognized the blue-white satin and old lace of her wedding dress. It was the custom in old New York for brides to appear in this costly garment during the first year or two of marriage. His mother, he knew, kept hers in tissue paper in the hope that Janey might some day wear it, though poor Janey was reaching the age when pearl-gray poplin and no bridesmaids would be thought more appropriate. It struck Archer that May, since their return from Europe, had seldom worn her bridal satin, and the surprise of seeing her in it made him compare her appearance with that of the young girl he had watched with such blissful anticipations 2 years earlier. Though May's outline was slightly heavier, as her goddess-like build had foretold, her athletic erectness of carriage and the girlish transparency of her expression remained unchanged. But for the slight languor that Archer had lately noticed in her, she would have been the exact image of the girl playing with the bouquet of lilies of the valley on her betrothal evening. The fact seemed an additional appeal to his pity. Such innocence was as moving as the trustful clasp of a child. Then he remembered the passionate generosity latent under that incurious calm. He recalled her glance of understanding when he had urged that their engagement should be announced at the Beaufort Ball. He heard the voice in which she had said in the Mission Garden, "I couldn't have my happiness made out of a wrong to someone else." And an uncontrollable longing seized him to tell her the truth, to throw himself on her generosity and ask for the freedom he had once refused. Newland Archer was a quiet and self-controlled young man. Conformity to the discipline of a small society had become almost his second nature. It was deeply distasteful to him to do anything melodramatic and conspicuous, anything Mr. van der Luyden would have deprecated and the club box condemned as bad form. But he had become suddenly unconscious of the club box, of Mr. van der Luyden, of all that had so long enclosed him in the warm shelter of habit. He walked along the semicircular passage at the back of the house and opened the door of Mrs. van der Luyden's box as if it had been a gate into the unknown. "Mama!" thrilled out the triumphant Marguerite, and the occupants of the box looked up in surprise at Archer's entrance. He had already broken one of the rules of his world, which forbade the entering of a box during a solo. Slipping between Mr. van der Luyden and Sillerton Jackson, he leaned over his wife.
"I've got a beastly headache. Don't tell anyone, but come home, won't you?" he whispered.
May gave him a glance of comprehension, and he saw her whisper to his mother, who nodded sympathetically. Then she murmured an excuse to Mrs. van der Luyden and rose from her seat just as Marguerite fell into Faust's arms. Archer, while he helped her on with her opera cloak, noticed the exchange of a significant smile between the older ladies. As they drove away, May laid her hand shyly on his. "I'm so sorry you don't feel well. I'm afraid they've been overworking you again at the office."
"No, it's not that. Do you mind if I open the window?" he returned confusedly, letting down the pane on his side.
He sat staring out into the street, feeling his wife beside him as a silent, watchful interrogation, and keeping his eyes steadily fixed on the passing houses. At their door, she caught her skirt in the step of the carriage and fell against him.
"Did you hurt yourself?" he asked, steadying her with his arm.
"No, but my poor dress. See how I've torn it," she exclaimed. She bent to gather up a mud-stained breadth and followed him up the steps into the hall. The servants had not expected them so early, and there was only a glimmer of gas on the upper landing. Archer mounted the stairs, turned up the light, and put a match to the brackets on each side of the library mantelpiece. The curtains were drawn, and the warm, friendly aspect of the room smote him like that of a familiar face met during an unavowable errand. He noticed that his wife was very pale and asked if he should get her some brandy. "Oh, no," she exclaimed with a momentary flush as she took off her cloak. "But hadn't you better go to bed at once?" she added, as he opened a silver box on the table and took out a cigarette. Archer threw down the cigarette and walked to his usual place by the fire. "No, my head is not as bad as that." He paused. "And there's something I want to say. Something important that I must tell you at once." She had dropped into an armchair and raised her head as he spoke. "Yes, dear," she rejoined, so gently that he wondered at the lack of wonder with which she received this preamble. "May," he began, standing a few feet from her chair and looking over at her as if the slight distance between them were an unbridgeable abyss. The sound of his voice echoed uncannily through the home-like hush, and he repeated, "There is something I've got to tell you. About myself." She sat silent, without a movement or a tremor of her lashes. She was still extremely pale, but her face had a curious tranquillity of expression that seemed drawn from some secret inner source. Archer checked the conventional phrases of self-accusal that were crowding to his lips. He was determined to put the case baldly, without vain recrimination or excuse. "Madame Olenska," he said. But at the name, his wife raised her hand as if to silence him. As she did so, the gaslight struck on the gold of her wedding ring.
"Oh, why should we talk about Ellen tonight?" she asked with a slight pout of impatience.
"Because I ought to have spoken before."
Her face remained calm.
"Is it really worthwhile, dear? I know I've been unfair to her at times. Perhaps we all have. You've understood her, no doubt, better than we did. You've always been kind to her. But what does it matter now it's all over?"
Archer looked at her blankly. Could it be possible that the sense of unreality in which he felt himself imprisoned had communicated itself to his wife? "All over? What do you mean?" he asked in an indistinct stammer.
May still looked at him with transparent eyes. "Why, since she's going back to Europe so soon, since Granny approves and understands and has arranged to make her independent of her husband—"
She broke off, and Archer, grasping the corner of the mantelpiece in one convulsed hand and steadying himself against it, made a vain effort to extend the same control to his reeling thoughts.
"I supposed," he heard his wife's even voice go on, "that you had been kept at the office this evening about the business arrangements. It was settled this morning, I believe."
She lowered her eyes under his unseeing stare, and another fugitive flush passed over her face.
He understood that his own eyes must be unbearable, and turning away, rested his elbows on the mantel shelf and covered his face. Something drummed and clanged furiously in his ears. He could not tell if it were the blood in his veins or the tick of the clock on the mantel.
May sat without moving or speaking while the clock slowly measured out 5 minutes. A lump of coal fell forward in the grate, and hearing her rise to push it back, Archer at length turned and faced her.
"It's impossible," he exclaimed.
"Impossible?
How do you know what you've just told me?"
"I saw Ellen yesterday. I told you I'd seen her at Granny's."
"It wasn't then that she told you."
"No, I had a note from her this afternoon. Do you want to see it?" He could not find his voice, and she went out of the room and came back almost immediately. "I thought you knew," she said simply. She laid a sheet of paper on the table, and Archer put out his hand and took it up. The letter contained only a few lines. "May dear, I have at last made Granny understand that my visit to her could be no more than a visit, and she has been as kind and generous as ever. She sees now that if I return to Europe, I must live by myself, or rather with poor Aunt Medora, who is coming with me. I am hurrying back to Washington to pack up, and we sail next week. You must be very good to Granny when I'm gone, as good as you've always been to me. Ellen. If any of my friends wish to urge me to change my mind, please tell them it would be utterly useless." Archer read the letter over 2 or 3 times, then he flung it down and burst out laughing. The sound of his laugh startled him. It recalled Janie's midnight fright when she had caught him rocking with incomprehensible mirth over May's telegram announcing that the date of their marriage had been advanced.
"Why did she write this?" he asked, checking his laugh with a supreme effort.
May met the question with her unshakable candor. "I suppose because we talked things over yesterday."
"What things?"
"I told her I was afraid I hadn't been fair to her, hadn't always understood how hard it must have been for her here, alone among so many people who were relations and yet strangers, who felt the right to criticize and yet didn't always know the circumstances." She paused. "I knew you'd been the one friend she could always count on, and I wanted her to know that you and I were the same in all our feelings." She hesitated, as if waiting for him to speak, and then added slowly, "She understood my wishing to tell her this. I think she understands everything." She went up to Archer, and taking one of his cold hands, pressed it quickly against her cheek. "My head aches, too. Good night, dear," she said, and turned to the door, her torn and muddy wedding dress dragging after her across the room.